You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. In 2010, Alpa Shah found herself dressed as a man in an olive-green uniform on a seven-night trek with the communist guerrillas in India. The only woman and the only non-combatant in the column, she walked 250 kilometres in the dense hilly forests of eastern India. Night March tells the story of India's revolutionary movement, a movement that many people may not be aware of. Here to tell us more about the book is Alpa Shah. Alpa, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles.
Good to have you with us. We tend to think of India as this new, bright, shining, modern, progressive nation where everybody is getting along in harmony. Your book paints a different picture.
Well, yes, it's a contradictory picture to the one you've just highlighted, which is, of course, a common one. India's had these incredible growth rates that the rest of the world has marveled at, you know, 7% has not been unusual. But at the same time, there is an India that is hidden by that light, which is an India of rising inequality. You know, although now there are more than 100 billionaires, economists have argued that income inequality is higher now than any time since 1922. So India's top 1% of the population now holds 73% of its wealth. But there's also a huge number of people living below the international poverty line. 58% is a recent figure. So it's an India of it's a story which is actually common in many parts of the world today, which is a story of rising inequality. 90% of Indians actually work in the informal employment, so they have no formal contracts. They're working as precarious labor, hired at a moment's notice, fired in a similar way, no health insurance, no welfare benefits. 8 Indian states have more poor people than 26 of Africa's poorest countries put together. So the story that we hear of India shining is a very partial story, and everywhere there are people rising up in protests against the various forms of inequalities that have historically been present, but also are being generated anew. And perhaps the people that I lived with in the forested hills of central and eastern India, the tribal people of India, have perhaps been the most neglected part of the Indian population, although they make up about 100 million people. And they have been involved in various forms of protests. And in recent years, they have become the foot soldiers of a long-standing communist revolutionary movement that's been going on since 1967. It's called the Naxalite movement, and they're inspired by Marx, Lenin, and Mao Zedong. You know, one thinks that such kind of communist movements are a thing of the past, but in India, they're very much alive and kicking.
And so whereabouts exactly are we talking about? We're talking central to eastern India. Obviously, it's a huge country. Where are the nearest cities so that we can get the listeners can get a rough idea of where we're talking about?
So an overnight train journey from Calcutta going east an overnight fast train journey going from Delhi south. So we're talking about the eastern hills. The closest big cities are Patna. There's a city called Ranchi, which is the capital of the state of Jharkhand. So this area used to be part of the state that was known as Bihar, which was India's poorest state, and it split off into a state which is the size of Ireland in 2000, based on a long-standing struggle for autonomy for its tribal people. So it's a place that, you know, the Lonely Planet, actually, when I first went out there, it had half a paragraph on, you know, it's a kind of place which hasn't been on the tourist map, but it's a place which contains, you know, a huge section of the Indian population, especially some of its poorest people.
And how did you find out about this, and how did you hear? Because it's underreported. I mean, I certainly hadn't heard anything about what's going on in this particular part of the country. How did you find about this insurgency, and how did you approach and be accepted by these Marxist rebels?
Well, I'm an anthropologist, so I'm one of these kind of unusual people who spends a lot of time with people who, you know, one wants to know about, and I spent a lot of time. So I ended up in this area because I was interested in development and how to alleviate poverty, and I had a lecturer in Cambridge who was working in this region, and he said, come along and see what we're doing here. And so I went along and I spent 3 months there, and that was when I was 23, and I got fascinated by this region because it was a place where most international development agencies, whether it's the World Bank or UNICEF or even non-governmental organizations like Oxfam or ActionAid, they were increasingly getting interested in because it was one of the poorest parts of the world. And so I became interested in trying to understand how their development programs were affecting these poor people and how they were reaching down to them or not, as the case was. And so as an anthropologist, what we do is we spend a huge amount of time living with people whose lives we want to learn about. We learn their local languages. We live with them in their mud huts, in my case. And we become a part of their families. So that's what I ended up doing. So I lived in these areas for it's been about 4.5 years since I first went there. And I found myself in my last trip of 1.5 years living in one of the rebel strongholds. And I thought, I didn't think I'd ever meet a rebel and meet a guerrilla. I just wanted to understand how the lives of poor tribal people in the villages had changed in the face of this rebel insurgency. But of course, I found when I was living there that they were everywhere. So people from almost every single household had joined the guerrilla armies. They had a sister or a brother or an aunt or an uncle who had been in the rebel armies. And so this idea that I had of these revolutionaries that were living in the forest or impinging on these villages now and again was quite removed from the reality, because there was you couldn't draw a strict boundary between the people and the insurgents.
And what I mean, one of the other things that I found interesting is the fact that the insurgents also go and work, if the work comes to them, go and work helping to build the skyscrapers and the modern buildings and the infrastructure of the modern India. You found.
Well, these are the tribal people who join the guerrilla armies, and you know, it's often thought that the world theories of such guerrilla insurgencies are that people are either joining them because of greed, so they provide some kind of access to monetary resources or resources that they don't have otherwise, or because of grievance, so they've been long oppressed, exploited, and these rebel insurgencies erupt and they address the people, and so people join them. But what I found is a much more complicated scenario, which is that the insurgents had become so much a part of people's kinship and family networks that the tribals who lived in the area moved in and out of their guerrilla armies as though they were going to live with an uncle or an aunt. So some parts of the year they might go and live with the guerrilla armies, and other parts of the year they might be going to New Delhi or Bombay or Calcutta, building, working in the construction industry, earning some money, working as precarious labor, carrying bricks on their shoulders, and then coming back home. So they were moving in and out of the guerrilla armies in a similar way. So they were and out of their migrant labor jobs. And that's what I was trying to show.
And what sort of forms does the insurgency take? I mean, are we talking about attacks on police stations? Are we talking about attacks on army installations, infrastructure, railway lines, water pipes? I mean, what are they trying to accomplish in terms of guerrilla warfare? And how is that impacting? And how are the Indian authorities reacting to this?
It's changed over time. When the insurgency started, they were attacking large landlords who had taken over the land of poor people and who were working on their land now. And so they were trying to get rid of these big landlords and redistribute the land to the landless people. But as the insurgents moved into the areas where I found them in these forested hills, they have increasingly turned against the state. The main attacks are now on the police forces, on the armed wings of the state coming into the area, and the warfare is very low key. They're a force of, you know, less than 10,000, and the Indian state is very, very powerful and has set 100,000 troops to surround these guerrilla zones. So the guerrillas will rarely ever engage in face-to-face battles. Mainly, it's the planting of landmines, which they make in the forests, used to blow up the security force vehicles as they rise up into, they try and climb into the hills. And through that, they will sometimes acquire guns. If they make a bomb, which is, powerful enough to blow up the vehicle, but not powerful enough to blow up the arms as well. So then they'll retrieve the arms. So a lot of their arms are actually snatched from the police and the Indian security forces. And they're attacking mainly the security forces. Sometimes they have big economic blockades. So they're protesting against the form of economic growth that the Indian state has taken, and they're against the big corporations that are trying to come into the area to harvest the mineral wealth that lies under the land. And so they'll declare these big economic blockades, saying that, you know, all trains taking coal or iron ore out of the area all have to stop functioning on these particular dates. And if they don't, you know, they'll try to blow up, put a landmine under the rail tracks. So it's mainly that kind of warfare.
And I mean, this is the sort of thing that we've seen over perhaps it's the 20th century, a 20th century thing, because we saw, you know, the great communist insurgencies. Was it perhaps, did you try discussing ideology with the leaders of the insurgency? Because many would say that the communist ideology, the socialist ideology, sort of the great insurgencies of China and the Soviet Union and other places in the Southeast Asia have by and large dissipated. Or are they staunchly believing in their Marxist socialist ideology?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, there's the difference between the leaders of these movements and those ordinary foot soldiers who are coming out in and out of the movement, as I was describing earlier. So the leaders are often from very well-to-do backgrounds. They're from India's, you know, most prominent, dominant families, upper castes, and they've been underground for 23, 24, 30 years, some of them even. And they're older, and they are firm believers in Marx, in communism, and what they argue is that we haven't seen communism yet. You know, that what we saw in Russia or China was a state socialism, state communism, and what they're aiming for is this kind of egalitarian utopia where eventually the state will wither away, where there won't be any capitalism, it will be a very egalitarian society. So they're arguing that we've never had the kind of communism that they're fighting for. But they're very inspired by and seek lessons from all the past communist insurgency. They trace their own roots back to, you know, the long history of communist movements back in Europe, and of course China as well. So and they've been very interested over the years in the Filipino communist movements. They've been interested in even the American communist parties, and apparently comrades from these various other movements have visited them in their forests, and they've, you know, had arms training from them, or they've had ideological discussions with them. So they're still, you know, they're probably our last surviving communist insurgency that's focusing on, you know, arms and armed insurgency seeking this communist utopia.
Having spent time with them and having been on the Night March, which is the title of the book, where do you think this movement goes? Do you think it will continue? Do you think it might wither? Do you think it may inspire other tribes, other castes throughout India to take a look at the reality behind the bright, shining utopian India that we are fed by the media all the time?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think in its present form, they are totally surrounded by the Indian state with its huge armed forces, its very fancy equipment, and I can't see that an armed movement of the kind that they have right now surviving that. That what I've just said has been said over and over again in over the last 50 years. It's been thought that, okay, finally this movement has been wiped out. But then again, you know, it resurfaces a few years later as leaders are jailed, as people are killed, you know, and those who are left behind have remobilized and recreated the movements, whether it's in the fields in the forest or in the prisons, in India's prisons. And they reignited sparks against the inequality that India, that many Indians are facing. So it's a difficult question to ask. It's a difficult question to answer because in the current moment in time, it looks like, you know, all is definitely gloom and doom for this movement, and it's also turning against itself. You know, turning to arms taking up arms against the state has its own consequences, even inside the movement, where people turn against each other. So it's breaking up from outside and breaking up from inside. But in terms of the future, it's very hard to predict because it's kind of it's done what people have. It's persisted despite moments of gloom. And what I think will definitely happen is that it certainly brought an awareness of the exploitation and oppression that many people in the country face, and has ignited and reignited many other kinds of movements. And I think this movement will create tribal movements, will create women's movements, both because they're inspired by this Naxalite insurgency, but also because they're disappointed by the way in which it has proceeded. So it's definitely, I think, been a force of both its own failure and also its own kind of regeneration.
The book is called Night March, Amongst the Guerrillas of India's Revolutionary Movement. It's out this month with Hearst Publishers. It's by Alper Shah. Alper, if people want to find out more about this or get in contact, is there social media? Is there a website? Where can people find out more about this unreported revolution?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. It's AlpaShah001. Hearst has a website. It's on Amazon. It'll be in all good bookshops. And there's going to be various book events and book launches around it. So watch out. They'll be advertised by Hearst on their Twitter accounts and by myself as well.
Alper Shah, thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much, Giles. Bye.